Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, California this week hit the grim milestone of becoming the first state to record more than 3 million coronavirus infections. Governor Gavin Newsom promised the state would vaccinate 1 million people in 10 days, but delayed data collection made it unclear if the state met that goal, and there are concerns the sluggish vaccine rollout, combined with virus mutations, could threaten the state's recent progress on COVID-19 hospitalizations. We assess the situation in California with Dr. Bob Wachter after this news. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. California's surge in coronavirus cases is finally showing signs of receding, but the state's death toll remains staggeringly high, with a record 736 deaths from COVID-19 in a single day that was set yesterday. At the same time, another variant of the virus appears to be prevalent across the state, a mutation that originated here. All this while our vaccine distribution continues to lag. Joining me now to talk about the situation in California and what we need from our state and federal government leaders is Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair in the Department of Medicine, University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Robert Wachter, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Mina. Thanks for having me.
So we are seeing these numbers flatten here that suggests the surge in coronavirus cases and hospitalizations is finally on the decline. What are you hearing, and do you expect this trend line to continue?
Yeah, it's really the first time now in about 2 months that things have stabilized and are beginning to come down. And that's true across the entire country. It's true in California. It's true in the hardest hit areas of California, which are in Southern California, particularly Los Angeles. It's true here in the Bay Area as well. And it took longer than I think most of us thought. This surge, the third surge, has gone on longer than the first two, the one in March and April, the one in June, July. But the experience with the prior surges is once things start to come down, they usually keep coming down. And so the curveball this time is these new variants, which appear, at least so far, to be more transmissible. And we'll talk, I'm sure, about sort of what that's likely to mean. But that's the thing that we don't understand. We have these two cross currents. We have these variants now entering the mix. And if they are more transmissible, they may make the improvement less steep than we have seen in the prior surges. On the other hand, we're also vaccinating people, which will protect the population increasingly as more and more people get vaccine. And so trying to game out what this is likely to be like for the next month or two is pretty tricky, because those two curveballs, the variants and the vaccines, both have the capacity to change their trajectory in ways that are a little predictable and to some extent slightly unpredictable.
Yes, and I definitely want to dig into those two curveballs, as you put it. One of the things that, yes, while of course we are, the numbers are flattening, they're flattening at a very high level still, it sounds like we're still in a very bad place, even though things are stabilizing. They're just stabilizing it at very high numbers. And one of the things that I noted in the introduction, of course, is that now we are seeing very high numbers of deaths. We're seeing devastating numbers from the Latinx and Black communities. We're also seeing a spike in Asian American communities. Is this the holiday surge, because death figures typically come later?
Yeah, I think that's likely. It's not entirely the holiday surge, because the numbers were terrible before the holidays. Mm-hmm. But I think a reasonable way of explaining what we're seeing now is that we might normally have seen cases begin to fall in late December, early January, and deaths to lag a week or two behind that. But because of the holidays, people congregated more. And so the impact of the holidays is playing out now. I think everybody's now familiar with the timeline that from the day you're exposed, 5 or 6 days later, you will get, you'll test positive and you may begin to get sick. If you're destined to need to go to the hospital, that's a week or so after that. And sadly, if you're destined to do poorly and go to the ICU and die, that may be a couple of weeks after that. So the timing about now we're close to a month out from the holidays, that would be the timing to be seeing the impact on deaths. So deaths are a lagging indicator, as are hospitalizations. The comforting part is that the two things we look for to see what's happening now, and that is the number of new cases being diagnosed and also the test positivity rate, two numbers that I think people have become familiar with. Mm-hmm. Both of those have stabilized and are actually trending downward in the Bay Area and throughout California and throughout the United States. And that would then indicate that the deaths are probably at their peak now and should start coming down. But they're at a peak in a terrible place. I mean, it's easy to say it's stabilized. We should feel good about that. I mean, we're talking about stabilizing at a national level, stabilizing at a death rate that's higher than 9/11 per day. It's unbelievable. Los Angeles has stabilized and is beginning to come down. But yesterday they had about 250 deaths in Los Angeles, just as a sign of how well San Francisco has done and has continued to do, even though we are having our worst surge. The number of deaths in LA yesterday was about the same as the number of deaths that we've had in San Francisco since March. And yes, LA is bigger, but it's 11 times bigger, not that much bigger. So even though we talk about the California surge and it has been terrible, and San Francisco and the Bay Area has had its worst surge since the start of this, it still is nowhere near the dimensions and the tragedy that they've been seeing in Southern California.
You know, I was struck, Dr. Walker, by a tweet of yours saying that we have to push ourselves to avoid becoming desensitized to COVID's toll. What made you tweet that?
Well, it is very easy to hear these numbers every day and say, okay, 4,000 people died, and not process what that means. And we do that because we're humans, and the human brain does that to protect itself. I mean, it's partly, you know, when I went to medical school, it's partly an exercise in desensitization. Because if you reacted deeply to every single death, you couldn't do your job. And so, the challenge for all of us as humans and citizens is to sort of process the numbers and defend against being immobilized by them and hiding under tables, and yet recognize that each one of those numbers is, you know, think about someone you know or a family member, someone in your community who you're close to. And I think by now, most of us do know people who have died of COVID. It's just hard to get your arms around what it means for 4,000 of those events to happen every single day in the country, and many times that if you go around the world. So I've been trying to figure out, when I've been tweeting about this, one of the things I try to do periodically is see, are there ways of describing this that give you a sense of the dimensions? And one I did the other day was, if we think about Hurricane Katrina and the scope of that tragedy, it killed 1,500 people in New Orleans, and it really was a profound tragedy. And it felt very real because you could kind of see it on TV, and you saw people dying, and it was terrible. 1,500 people died of it in New Orleans. The fact that we have now more than 400,000 deaths in the United States is the equivalent of the entire population of New Orleans dying. And, you know, it's sort of almost trying to come up with ways of pushing ourselves to, without being immobilized or being unduly scared, but to really recognize the profound human toll that this thing has taken and continues to take. And again, we talk about, well, it's stabilized and it's coming down and you can feel good about that, but it's still at a really, really awful level, and at a level where, you know, a year ago, if we'd said to ourselves, 4,000 people a day are going to die of this, or we will have had 400,000 people die in the United States, I think all of us would have said, oh, that's not going to happen. How could that possibly happen? Well, it has happened.
And as you mentioned, you're concerned now that some of the virus mutations that we're seeing, coupled with, you know, trying to get this vaccine out, but having some difficulty with that, could potentially or shift or change the trajectory a little bit that we're on right now. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how concerned we should be about these virus variants, particularly the one we're hearing about more recently now, this California one, one that originated here. I mean, what do we know about it?
Well, the first thing we know about variants is that these viruses mutate all the time. And I've been asked for a year, what do these mutations mean? And the answer up until a month or two ago was nothing really. It's sort of like a little typo in a very long book and doesn't really change the nature of the book. And that really was the case until relatively recently, where two versions of mutations have appeared, and there's some overlap and it gets kind of complicated. But sort of the best way I think of understanding it is there are now mutations in the virus's gene structure that can do one of two things, and maybe a little bit of both. One thing it can do is to make the virus more infectious or more contagious. And that is basically the nature of the mutation that they've seen in the UK. And the ways they know that, or they know kind of from looking at the structure of the virus, that it's hitting parts of the virus that they worried about that might happen. But then looking epidemiologically and seeing that a version of the virus, this particular mutation, which in November they found a few cases here and there, very quickly became the dominant strain in London. And that just says that once you get, it's sort of like you're having a race with 10 different runners. And if one of them gets a little bit of superpower, it all of a sudden will go from being last in the pack to being first in the pack. It just shows it's better at its job. And so this mutation is better at its job of infecting people, probably because when it touches the back of someone's nose or throat, which is where the virus sort of burrows in, it binds a little bit more strongly than the version that we've been dealing with for the past year. So that's what we know about the UK variant, and it is in the United States, including in California. We don't know how much because we haven't been testing for variations and for mutations enough, but we know it's here, and so the concern is that it will spread. The new twist on that theme is that my colleague at UCSF, Charles Chu, has identified a variant that is not the UK variant. It's a variant that was found here in California. And when he first identified it, I think a couple of months ago, it represented a pretty small fraction of cases. And then when he went back in to some areas of California and asked what percentage of the overall COVID cases are represented by that variant, it had grown quite a lot, I think from a couple of percent to 20 or 25%, which might be just sort of random sampling changes. But might indicate that it's doing what the UK variant did, which is it's more infectious, it's running faster than the other variants. And I think we have to approach it and the fact that the UK variant is here as being sort of a generic threat. We may now be dealing with at least some segment of the viruses in our community that do not act exactly the way that we have gotten used to, but for the same kind of encounter or the same amount of risk that you might have taken a few months ago and got away with, if it's this virus that you're coming into contact with, it's more likely to actually infect you.
Well, I'm really glad that you explained the transmissibility factor, because I've been curious about what more transmissible actually means. We'll have more with Dr. Bob Wachter after the break about the situation with the coronavirus in California. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're looking at California's challenges in containing the coronavirus. We're joined by Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair in the Department of Medicine at UCSF. And you are invited to join our conversation. What are your questions for Dr. Bob Wachter? How have you been trying to access the vaccine? What has been your experience trying to get it for you or a loved one? And what are your questions about the virus variants? Are you reassessing risks or adjusting your behaviors based on all these unknowns around them? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Dr. Wachter, one of the things that we haven't talked about yet was the South African variant. It feels like that's one that people are really watching closely and are most concerned about right now.
Yeah, so the South African variant has a different twist on the theme, and that is that the mutations seem to alter the target of antibodies and at least raise the possibility that vaccines or natural immunity won't work quite as well. At least at some level, that was theoretical. But now there's a study that just came out in preprint form a couple of days ago that showed that the kinds of antibodies that normally would kill the virus seem to work half the time and didn't work half the time, which does raise the possibility that either natural infection-related immunity or vaccine-related immunity will not be as effective as it was for the old virus. Now, the good news is that that South African variant has not yet been reported in the United States. I think we're trying hard to keep it out if we can, and we're trying hard to test for it or test gene sequences enough so that we can find it if it gets here. So it's not sort of a clear and present danger, but it does raise the possibility that we may ultimately be looking at two possible variations that cause trouble. One being this idea that it's more transmissible. The second being that vaccines work less well. Are they going to completely not work? I think that most of the virologists and vaccinologists I talk to tell me that that's highly unlikely. But will it degrade the effectiveness of a vaccine? Right now, we know the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines are 95% effective in preventing cases of COVID once you've finished your second shot. Is it possible it lowers that from 95 to 70%? I think that's a real possibility. And so it's one of the reasons we want to get people vaccinated as quickly as possible to try to dampen down the entire COVID pandemic in the United States before we have to deal with that. But it would not be impossible that the end game here is we're vaccinated, the virus goes away, and then we've got to get revaccinated with a newly formulated vaccine that specifically attacks this new and improved virus sometime in the future.
Well, let me go to caller Frank in San Jose. Hi, Frank.
Hi, how you doing? The panelist, the guest here, was talking about the numbness that we may be experiencing over this death rates. And I'm wondering, maybe with the new administration, it's time that the Biden administration, for example, hold a press conference, maybe with some celebrities, and I'm not kidding about that, and have them reintroduced to the citizenry the concept of using a mask, what type of masks are most effective, and what social distancing means. In other words, reintroducing, refreshing people about the ways in which they can prevent this virus from spreading. I wonder if it's time to do that. It's been a year, and the numbness is setting in. So maybe it's time to, you know, in a way that's very I don't want to use the word enjoyable, but palatable to a lot of people so that more people will watch it, you know, have people be reintroduced to that whole concept.
Frank, thanks. Dr. Wachter?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. I agree with that. I think that, you know, the new administration offers an opportunity for a reset button. And there were a lot of things that did not go right under the Trump administration around COVID and essentially everything except for the vaccine development process. And so and I think the point is really quite important on two levels. One is it's easy to focus on vaccines, and that is the appropriate focus. We got to speed this up. We got to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. But we're not out of this mess under the best possible circumstances for 6 or 8 months. And until then, our mainstays of protecting ourselves are the things we've been talking about for a year. It's masks, it's distancing, it's all that. And so it's one thing to have the president talk about it and model it. That's great. It's another thing to have Dr. Fauci, who now is clearly unplugged, if you watched him yesterday.
Yes, I did.
Liberated, doing that. That's also great. But we've not really taken advantage of influencers. I mean, getting people to wear masks, it would be great to have celebrities and sports stars do it. You know, having me tell somebody is probably less important for a 25-year-old than having their favorite TikTok star do it. And I think we've got to think more, you know, in a more careful, strategic way about how do you get people to alter their behavior, and particularly as they're getting fatigued almost a year into it. That's a really important point.
Do we need to adjust our behaviors, you know, in response to these virus variants? I mean, how should we be assessing our risk right now with these unknowns that you were describing?
I think the most important thing is that you redouble your efforts to do what you're supposed to have been doing all along. And many of us, you know, did, but then you just begin to slip because that's, again, normal human behavior. So if you have, it is the time to say, you know, let me be sure I am wearing a mask when I'm around other people. Let me be sure I'm trying to stay 6 feet away. Now, if you said, well, you just told me this thing is 50% more infectious, shouldn't I be 50% more careful? Say if you've, and the answer is that's not a crazy thing to do. That if you have been really, really careful and you haven't let down your guard, and you say, well, you know, this variant seems to be taking off, it wouldn't be unreasonable to wear a thicker mask or wear two masks rather than one. Or if you were meeting people 6 feet away, think about making that 8 feet away. It's not a ridiculous thing to do, but I think by far the most important thing to do is just redouble your efforts. There's no reason to believe that the variants will get around a mask any better than the old virus. The key thing is that you have the mask on.
And also in the meantime, we are not getting the vaccine, of course, as quickly as we thought. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that, Dr. Wachter. I mean, we were seeing recent reports that now that we're trying to vaccinate the entire 65 and older population, that it could potentially, given the rate at which we're getting new doses now, it could mean maybe 4 or 5 months by the time that that's complete. I mean, what do you think needs to happen to speed up and improve this process?
Well, I think it's happening now. I think it's happening at a national level. There, if you watched the press conferences the last couple of days and the executive orders, there is now a national plan that's being rolled out, so that's important. At the state level, I think we were slow on this, and I think even the state leaders would probably admit that. I think in the last week or two, we have turned up the heat and recognized that this is not, can't be business as usual when 4,000 people a day are dying. And so we have to gear up these mass vaccination sites. We have to figure out the computer systems to get people scheduled, all that kind of stuff. We did not approach as an emergency for the first few weeks, and I think we are now. We always knew there was going to be a bottleneck. We thought the bottleneck was going to be supply, that there's just not enough vaccine being churned out from the companies.
Right.
And I think that still will be. But what has been surprising is for the past month, the bottleneck really has been distribution almost over anything, meaning the vaccine is in California. It's in freezers and refrigerators. It's ready to go. But as of today, we have injected 37% of it, meaning 60% of it is still ready to be given, but the systems to do that are not quite there. Now, to be fair, I've seen what we've had to do at UCSF to vaccinate more than 22,000 people. These systems are complicated. It's much more complicated than giving flu vaccine because of the storage requirements, because of the need to bring someone back for a second dose. So the tracking systems, the consent systems, it's complicated. It all happened over the holidays. That took some time. In California, particularly in Southern California, if you're asking hospitals to do it, the hospitals are overwhelmed taking care of patients with COVID. So there are a lot of reasons for early speed bumps. But I think now we're at a time where we just can't tolerate anything other than every dose of vaccine that we have gets injected. We set up the systems. I think what's going to happen is that will happen in the next few weeks. Then we're going to hit the bottleneck we thought we'd have, which is that the supply is simply not as much as it needs to be. And I know the administration is trying to move that along, but it is going to be a bottleneck until probably April. And then in April, we'll hit a third problem, which we need to be preparing for now, which is, okay, the supply is there. How do we be sure that everybody who should get vaccinated is accepting the vaccine? And certainly hope they do. The vaccine is remarkably effective and remarkably safe, but we need to be sure it's accessible to people, and we need to be sure that people actually take it.
Well, I think you're getting to answering partly this listener's question. Jody tweets, I've been trying to advocate for my parents, both over 70 and one with an underlying health condition, to get their vaccines, and I'm terribly disappointed at the disparities between communities and counties within California. We also lag behind other states. Why? So you did get to that. Very quickly, if you get the vaccine and then there's a delay beyond the recommended 3 weeks of getting the second dose, is it less effective then if you wait longer between the first and second dose?
No, it doesn't appear to be. And I actually wrote an editorial in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago with a colleague where we argued that maybe we should delay the second doses in order to get more people vaccinated with their first dose more quickly. The numbers here are that if you take the first dose of either one, the Pfizer or the Moderna, by the time you're ready for your second dose, you're already about 80% protected. Now, you need to get that second dose because that's what gets you to 95%. And there's no question that it gives you a much more durable, robust amount of protection. So there's no argument about needing the second dose. But delaying the second dose for a few weeks, nobody believes that that's going to get in the way of your ultimate immunity. In a few weeks of delay, there's no real significant chance that you're going to become more susceptible. In other words, that your immunity will wane. The real risk is that people may hear that and say, oh, you're telling me I can delay the second dose. I don't want to get it. After the first dose, I felt a little crummy, so I don't want to get it. That is not the message. The message is you absolutely have to have the second dose. If it turns out it's not available and you've got to wait a few weeks for it, that's perfectly fine.
Let me go to caller Allison in Oakland. Hi, Allison.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Yes, my sister and my mother are living together, and my sister has an appointment for a vaccine tomorrow through her HMO. She is in her late 60s and in perfect health. My mother is 94 and has a health condition. She does not belong to an HMO, and she has not been notified of any vaccine availability whatsoever. I'm finding that somewhat of a problem with the delivery of the vaccines, and I don't want to say it's deliberately misprioritizing, but because of the lack of organization and how people are notified and how it's made available, it seems unsafe.
Mm. Allison, thanks for making that point. Dr. Walter, I don't know if you can shed light on why that might be happening in Allison's case, but also Dr. Erica Pond made the point about how maybe one of the things that the state needs to do is focus primarily on age versus occupation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, the point that Allison is making is being seen in communities around California and being seen all over the country. I think we're all hearing from friends and relatives, and they got their vaccine in Florida and they didn't get it in Pennsylvania, and they got it in a town in California and didn't get it in another town. It's something of a chaotic mess, in part because of the consequences of not having had a national plan that guided us to one way of doing this. So everybody's doing improv, and that's not good. And it's led to some disparities of the kind that you just heard, that your 94-year-old person should get vaccinated before a 60-year-old person. The level of risk is probably 100-fold higher of dying. It's really, the effect of age on risk is profound. The good news is that as the vaccine becomes, the supply grows and our distribution systems grow, I will assume that the 94-year-old relative will be able to get vaccinated quite soon. At UCSF, we're now vaccinating our patients over 75. Once we've kind of gotten through at least some of them, we'll lower that number to 65. My own belief is that in a well-meaning effort to promote equity, we created something that was just too complex to work. And so my own belief is that age is such a profound risk factor here that we should have started with the oldest people above 75, then 65 to 75, then 55 to 65. And then I personally would have voted for a lottery. And I had an editorial in the New York Times about this a couple of weeks ago, to do everybody else. Now, you can make arguments for certain underserved populations, for certain jobs, for certain pre-existing conditions. They're all reasonable arguments, but I've been asking people for months, how is Walgreens, the clerk at Walgreens, going to figure out that you are a grocery store clerk, or you are a preschool teacher, or that your pre-existing condition should count and mine shouldn't? I had thyroid cancer when I was 22, 40 years ago. I'm pretty sure I'm cured. Is that a pre-existing condition? Do I need a note from my doctor? It's just, these are all good ideas sitting in a conference room, but when you actually try to operationalize them, they are really hard to make work. And I think it's partly what has hindered us. It's we've created so many complex systems and categories. Age is simple. It is a real, very, very large risk factor for hospitalizations and for deaths. It is doable. It's fair. I believe that we should have started with age, and I think that would have cleaned up some of the messiness that we're all seeing now.
We're talking with Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair in the Department of Medicine at UCSF, and we're talking about California's challenges containing the coronavirus, distributing the vaccine. And you can join us at 866-733-6786. You can email us, forum at kqed.org, or reach us on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum. And we're getting actually quite a few questions about the vaccine itself. Linda writes, can someone spread or transmit COVID after fully vaccinated?
That is the billion-dollar question, and we don't know the answer to that yet. What we know about the vaccines are they are remarkably safe. You've probably heard about these allergic reactions. They happen in 1 in 100,000 people, and nobody in the United States has died of one yet. You've heard about sort of reactions after the vaccine otherwise, and yes, a fair number of people will feel a little crummy the next day with maybe a little fever, muscle aches. I had my vaccine and it felt like somebody slapped my arm for a few hours the next day. It was really nothing. But there's no evidence of any long-term significant side effects. They are remarkably effective in preventing COVID, symptomatic cases of COVID, and severe cases of COVID. And the most remarkable statistic is in the two studies, Pfizer and Moderna, there were 40 patients that got really sick, went to the hospital or died in the studies. And then when they broke the code, it turned out all 40 patients had gotten placebo. Not a single one had been a patient who'd gotten vaccinated. So that's the great news. The thing we don't know for sure is, do they completely prevent you from catching the virus, it getting in the back of your nose or throat, you carrying it, and then you spreading it to someone else? There are no virologists that I've seen yet, or vaccinologists, who don't believe that it will markedly lower the probability of that. But the question is does it completely take it away? Is there no chance that you can catch it and then give it to someone else? I am fully vaccinated. My wife is not, which creates some marital strife, I have to say. So literally when I woke up the other day and she said, how'd I sleep? And I said, I slept the sleep of the vaccinated. So that was not smart. But I cannot say for sure that I could not go out and catch it and infect her. And until I am sure about that, even though I'm fully vaccinated, I am wearing a mask and doing all the things that I've been doing all along, trying to be super careful. Now, what I will do that I wouldn't have done a few months ago is when I have the chance, I'll get a professional haircut. When I have the chance, I'll see the dentist. And if I need to travel, I will, whereas I might not have done that. But I think we need to find out for sure whether or not this really does protect you against infection and spread.
We'll have more with Dr. Bob Wachter after the break about California's challenges, but also we'll be talking about the national picture and what national leadership can and should do. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
My fellow Americans, in the work ahead of us, we're going to need each other. We need all our strength to persevere through this dark winter. We're entering what may be the toughest and deadliest period of the virus. We must set aside politics and finally face this pandemic as one nation.
That's President Joe Biden in his inaugural address Wednesday. As we turn now to look at the national situation and the response from the Biden administration, we're here with Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair in the Department of Medicine at UCSF. And joining us now is Alexis Madrigal, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who runs The Atlantic's COVID tracking project. Alexis Madrigal, thanks so much for coming back to Forum.
Thanks for having me.
As Dr. Wachter mentioned earlier, we have lost so many Americans to this virus, more than 400,000. But it sounds like the COVID tracking project's numbers are finally showing that cases, hospitalizations are slowing and that the death count may as well.
Yeah, I think if we didn't have these variants of concern to think about that we've seen in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, as well as in California, I think we'd be pretty optimistic right now that we were over the peak. We've seen hospitalizations, which is a quite reliable number, falling nationally for over a week now. And we've also seen in every region of the country that number falling. Cases are falling. Deaths, we may be on a plateau for quite some time. There's quite a lag in reporting between when someone dies and when it actually shows up in a state report. But I think on the whole, we could say that the surge that we saw begin, you know, in October in the upper Midwest and spread across the whole country in November and December probably is easing. And I think that's the best news that we've had in several months, really.
And we heard in that clip of President Biden that we may well be entering the toughest part of this period of the virus. We also heard from basically his COVID coordination czar, Jeff Zients, quote, what we're inheriting from the Trump administration is so much worse than we could have imagined. This was in reference to a vaccine distribution plan. I mean, Alexis Madrigal, can you talk about some of the practical challenges that Biden's team is facing in terms of vaccine rollout, in terms of tracking cases and so on?
Sure. You know, I think there were always going to be some serious transitional problems, and the Trump administration didn't help anyone by holding back help for weeks during this crisis. I think one of the crucial problems, and this is not something we can necessarily pin on the Trump administration, though they didn't help solve it, is we have such a decentralized public health system in the United States that, you know, it's like 50 different countries doing things. And where that really gets problematic is in something like the vaccine rollout, where the Trump administration put a lot on the states to come up with their own plans. But there still has to be coordination between the federal government and the states in terms of sending out doses, in terms of understanding what the data is telling both the federal government as well as the states about what they have available and what's already been administered. And as we saw with testing in particular, that has just been a huge problem. And I think one of the very first things that the Biden administration seems to be doing is trying to figure out what the right set of systems should be. Unfortunately, they're having to do it in the midst of a quite serious situation, even though the numbers are down in relative terms. The absolute numbers of infections and deaths and hospitalizations in this country is still extremely high. And so it's really tricky because you don't want to break the things that are working, but you do need to fix a lot of stuff. And, you know, that may mean a rebalancing of responsibilities between the CDC and other parts of HHS. It may not. It may mean building new systems, going back to old ones. I mean, there's a lot of things that are on the table. And I think the Biden administration COVID folks are really just getting their first look at the innards over these first few days.
Again, Alexis Madrigal of The Atlantic also runs The Atlantic's COVID Tracking Project. You, our listeners, can join us 866-733-6786. You can email us forum at kqed.org or reach us on Twitter or Facebook at KQED Forum. And let me go to caller Jeff in Palo Alto. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, and thank you. Hello, Dr. Wachtel. I'm a primary care physician in Palo Alto, and I got qualified to be a vaccine site in December, but no vaccine has ever come. And I've recently gotten a letter from the County of Santa Clara saying they really don't plan to send vaccine to independent providers. I think it's a big missed opportunity. I know my patients, I vaccinated them for 20 years for shingles, tetanus, flu. Many are old, many don't do technology well. So I wonder if we could get an advocacy to try and get this vaccine in the hands of independent primary practices. I think it would be an excellent part of rolling out in a better way.
Jeff, thanks. Dr. Wachter, curious for your reaction to that. And also, I feel like sort of underlying what Jeff is talking about is maybe primary care physicians can do better in terms of addressing vaccine hesitancy.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And I think that we did not pay sufficient attention to all the last mile aspects here. And, you know, as Alexis was saying, the whole plan for the rollout was inadequately resourced and thought through. And so what that left was, all right, it's going to be big institutions, it'll be big medical centers like mine, it'll be health departments, but we have to now move it out into the field. Now, some of that's going to be big distribution sites and football stadiums and parking lots, but some of that is going to be moving into primary care offices, moving into your local Walgreens and CVS. We've got to do all of it. It's not going to be one solution, and I do think the primary care infrastructure has to be a big part of that.
Well, we are getting a couple of comments around anti-vaxxers. For example, Joanne writes, what is the best way to approach anti-vaxxers? Sarah writes, even if my entire immediate family is vaccinated, will it be safe to gather with our adamantly anti-vaccine extended family members? Any thoughts on that, Dr. Walker?
Yeah, I mean, there are two different groups I'd pay some attention to. There are anti-vaxxers who just don't believe in vaccines, and they're always going to be there, and they may not be convincible. And at some level, people choose not to be vaccinated. I think they're taking a remarkable risk when this thing is killing 4,000 people a day, but that is their choice. I think the bigger and more important group is people who have vaccine hesitancy. They wonder whether the vaccine was approved too quickly. They wonder, is it really going to turn out to be safe? I think that's going to be a robust, diverse information campaign, that some of which is going to be political leaders, some of which it's going to be experts and scientists and doctors, some of which it's going to be religious leaders or sports leaders. It's got to sort of try to understand what is it that people are worried about. In communities of color, there are often separate reasons why people have hesitancy. But before we assume that a low uptake, for example, in Black or Latinx community is because of vaccine hesitancy, we also have to be sure it's accessible to them. You know, are there pharmacies in their neighborhood that give it out? We've got to be really thoughtful about all of the reasons why people aren't taking it. We don't need 100% of people to be vaccinated. If we can get to numbers like 60 or 70%, when you add that number with the people who have had natural immunity from their infection, I think we will find ourselves reaching that level of herd immunity that we need. So it's not the last anti-vaxxer we have to get to. The bigger and more important group is people who sort of understandably are hesitant about it, but I think can be convinced.
Alexis Madrigal, as you talked about the federal government and some of the challenges that it faces. You know, right now it's going to try to set up community vaccination centers to deploy FEMA to do that, that it's going to deploy the Defense Production Act to get help for vaccine manufacturers. But this question around messaging, I know this is something that you've highlighted in terms of, you know, being one of the big mistakes of the Trump administration. What do we need right now from the Biden administration as far as messaging goes, do you think?
Well, I think Dr. Walker's the person who really knows what we need to be telling people. I think, you know, my own personal take on this is that when people see how effective the vaccine is in bringing down the number of people who are dying, that that's going to be as good as any messaging that we could possibly have. If you look at who's really dying, it's largely older people. There's actually not that many people who are over 70 in the United States. Our tracking of long-term care facilities basically sets a floor on the number of deaths that originated there, and I think it's about 40%. And we think it's actually probably even higher than that because we can't capture the entire country. So if we can just reach those long-term care facilities, we're talking about being able to massively cut down the number of people who are dying. And if we can obviously go outside of that to people who are at risk because of their age or and other comorbidities, I mean, we're talking like we could see deaths go down a lot. And I think when people see that, it's like the proof is in the pudding. And I'm hoping that that combined with the kind of public education campaign that Dr. Walker mentioned will be good. I also think, you know, the Trump administration did a real disservice, I think, you know, just with things like Operation Warp Speed and with, you know, over-promising and under-delivering on the vaccine rollout. And I do hope that with more adult responses and more responsible messaging about what's possible in terms of the vaccine rollout, that will start to bring around particularly people on the political left who might be vaccine hesitant.
Yes, Dr. Wachter, please.
One more quick point is I think you are going to begin to see workplaces, travel, and other places start requiring evidence of vaccination. And so it may, we're not going to be there yet, particularly when there's such a shortage, but I think by March or April, you will see a world in which, you know, going to a movie theater or going to get an airplane, you may need to show that you have evidence of immunity or vaccination. And that will change the formula as well, because people will see that, you know, their friends and family who have been vaccinated, their lives are beginning to return to them in ways that will not happen if you're not vaccinated.
Well, this listener writes, can your guest please address the issue that children will not be vaccinated until probably 2022? Everywhere I'm hearing about a return to more normalcy in the next 6 months or so, but that can't be the case until children are vaccinated. Can you address this?
I think I can say a couple things about it, just having observed the way the country has reacted to different levels of disease prevalence and death. I think we're not aiming to get to zero risk. I mean, that's just not where we're pointed. There's going to still be some disease transmission. And I think what we're really talking about is a rebalancing of the risk factors versus the risks of children not being in school and businesses not being open. And I, regardless of whether it's good or bad, I have an extremely hard time seeing most Americans accepting really intense restrictions, particularly around school. Going into the fall, like if deaths have come down a lot, I think it's going to be very difficult to make that case whether children have been vaccinated or not.
We're talking about the challenges containing the coronavirus. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Dr. Wachter, I don't know if you have anything to add. I know you need to leave us in a few minutes. I also would love to just read this listener's tweet. Because I think it also does get to kind of this place that we're at. This listener tweets, I'm getting mixed messaging that we're coming out of a bad peak, but also headed into the darkest time. I mean, what's the message that you think is important for, you know, us pandemic fatigued and also hurting Californians, Dr. Wachter?
Yeah. Thank you. Let me say one word about the students, and I will try to address that. There are studies now that are beginning for kids, and one study down to age two. And I think we'll have the answer about whether the vaccines are effective and safe in students probably by the summer. And then I think it will roll out in kids. But I think schools will be able to reopen before that. I think if all the adults are vaccinated in schools and the community prevalence rate of the virus is very low, I think we'll find that it's an environment where we all feel that it's safe enough with some changes in the way we organize the schools, that it's safe enough to open the schools. In terms of the question about the messaging, I'd say I'm very hopeful. I really do think the vaccines are a light at the end of the tunnel. It's easy to forget that in the beginning of November, we did not know that there would be vaccines that worked, period. And we were all saying, well, we hope they work as well as the flu vaccine, which would have been 60% effective. So the fact that we have two vaccines that are 95% effective and remarkably safe is unbelievably euphoric news. I mean, it's really, it's extraordinary. So we should look at that and say, you know, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. We now have an administration that's going to treat us like adults and put experts in charge of this. And I think the rollout's going to improve quite a bit. And the variants are the curveball that may alter the course of this. But I think that if you were a betting person, you would say that life by the summer or at latest the fall will return to something that looks awfully like normal, with very, very few deaths, very few hospitalizations, and people going back to the lives that they enjoyed before this thing started. So mixed messaging because it's bad right now, mixed messaging because we're not out of the woods, but the vaccines are extraordinary. And I think we have an administration that's going to do it right. I wish we'd had it a year ago, but I'm very, very hopeful about where we find ourselves.
Dr. Bob Wachter, professor and chair in the Department of Medicine at UC San Francisco, really appreciate having you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Alexis Madrigal, I'm struck by this listener's comment. Many people seem to brush off the high death count by thinking many of these people would have died anyway or had pre-existing conditions. I mean, as someone who has followed the trajectory of our nation, just curious what your reaction is to this.
I think most people who think that have fallen prey to the misinformation campaign that many people who wanted to minimize the pandemic for political reasons put out there. You know, many, many, many people have died from this disease. You know, one of the things that I think is so fascinating is, you know, polio, only one out of every 200 cases is severe. And yet no one ever said polio wasn't a big deal. I think it says something about our current political and informational environment that such a severe illness that could kill 400,000 people in a year would be minimized for any reason. And I think the truth is that it probably killed more people than that. And when we're able to look at the excess deaths calculations that the government does, I think we'll see that. And, you know, when all is said and done, we're probably talking about a disease that will have killed, you know, 500,000 to 700,000 Americans, and yet people are still trying to minimize it. Like, to me, it's unconscionable.
Are you feeling as confident as Dr. Wachter that we'll finally begin to contain the virus? I mean, how are you managing your own expectations?
Yeah, the variants are this curveball, right, as Dr. Wachter put it, and it sort of complicates what we've seen to this point in the pandemic. I am hopeful. I really am. And I'm really hopeful about the vaccines as well. And I think that people have kind of underplayed what a big impact they could have. They're also, you know, it's worth taking into account that, you know, probably something, then there's wide error bands on this, but probably something like 60 to 100 million people have already gotten COVID in the United States, right? So there's already a lot of people who've had it, and so presumably have some immunity. We don't know everything about how that works yet, but presumably have some immunity. We've got vaccines going to the most vulnerable populations. And it kind of seems like it's going to get continue getting better. And then there has been the seasonal component to this, at least it appears that way as well. So we have a lot of things going for us in terms of things getting better from the quite bad level that we're at now.
Well, thank you for the data that you've tracked from the beginning of this and the absence of it, and really appreciate having you on. Alexis Madrigal, who runs the Atlantic's COVID Tracking Project. Thanks to Blanca Torres and Mandy Nguyen for producing this segment. Forum is also produced by Judy Campbell, Ariana Prail, Susan Britton, and Caroline Smith. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, engineers Danny Bringer and Katie McMurrin, interns Leslie Torres and Kimia Akbari. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks, listeners, for listening, and have a good weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.